So I'm going to speak today about the nature of the mind, which is a personal favorite subject of mine. The mind is how you view the world. It's what allows you to view and experience reality. So it's very, very important to understand what it means to have a healthy mind according to our philosophical perspective, but also practically, what does that really mean in our current world? So I have a presentation today, which is a combination of Bhagavad Gita, as well as some modern ideas. So hopefully I'll have at least 30% of your interest to start out. And if you like the talk, then hopefully there'll be more attention as the talk continues. Jai Om Vishnu Pad Paramhamsa, Pri Raj Kacharya, Ashtu Trasta Shri Srimadis Divine Grace, Yesi Bhakti Nanda Swami Shri La Prabhupada Ki. Jai Om Vishnu Pad Paramhamsa, Pri Raj Kacharya, Ashtu Trasta Shri Srimadis Divine Grace, Shri La Bhakti Siddhanta Saraswati Thakur Prabhupada Ki.
Jai
Srimad Bhagavad Gita Ki.
Jai
Iskon Berlin Ki.
Jai
All the assembled devotees Ki.
Jai
Gaur Premanandi Ki. I'll chant the invocation prayers. If you know what they are, you can join me. We'll keep it short. Om Ajnanante Tivirandasya Jnananjana Shalakaya Chakshurunmilitam Yena Tasmai Shri Gurave Padaya Krishna Krishnaya Bhutale Srimate Bhakti Vedanta Swami Niti Namine Namaste Saraswati Deve Gaurani Pracharine Nirvishesha Shunyavadi Paschatyadeshatarine Stapitam yena bhutale Swayam rupa karamayam Dadati swaparantikam Namo mahamadanyaya Krishna prema pradayate Krishnaya Krishna chaitanya Namne gauratvishe namaha Krishna Karna Sindhu Dina Bandhu Jagatpate Gopesha Gopika Kanta Radha Kanta Namostute Tapta Kanchana Gorangi Radhe Vrindavaneshwari Vrishabhanu Sute Devi Pranamami Hari Priye Panchakalpa Kripa Sindhubhya Eva Cha Patitanam Pavanebhyo Vaishnavebhyo Namo Namaha Shri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Shri Advaita Gadadhara Shri Vasavi Gaura Bhakta Vrinda Hare Krishna 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 Hare 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 Rama Hare Rama 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 Hare Hare Imagine that you're blind. Just for a second. Just imagine that you cannot see anymore. And you find someone to help you around, walk around the city, go grocery shopping, take you to the temple on Saturdays. But somehow this person develops an enmity towards you. They don't like you anymore. And they're your sole source of navigation in this world. You cannot see. You haven't been trained to walk around the world as if you were blind. So you're depending on them to take you to the right places, to make sure you cross the street at the right time, to make sure they don't send you in circles all around the city. But somehow, because they're no longer your friend, they don't like you, they keep putting you in very difficult situations, and because you're blind, you can't figure out how to get out of this situation. This sounds quite painful, isn't it? also a little cruel if you think about it. Like, that's horrible. Like, if a blind person asks me, can you tell me what time it is? And I tell them, yeah, it's 4:30, and it's like, you know, 2 o'clock in the afternoon. That's pretty mean, isn't it? Now imagine the opposite. Imagine you are blind, but you have somebody with you who likes you very much. They appreciate you. They want to help you. So in fact, they actually think ahead of you, instead of you having to tell them every time where you want to go or what you need to do. They're already thinking how they can help you and how they can make it easier for you to go around the city and go from one place to another. That would be quite nice, isn't it? It's nice, right? That sounds like normal human behavior. Don't you think so? Right? Well, it's very interesting because in the Bhagavad Gita, which is our main book here, Krishna calls the mind your friend or your enemy. And this is a very fascinating statement. It comes in the context of self-realization. When the yogi is trying to realize himself, discover himself, Krishna says, hey, by the way, on this journey, your mind can play the role of your friend or your enemy. And in a sense, when we're conditioned, we're like blind. We don't exactly know what this world is all about. And so we're really depending on our mind to kind of help us, right? And if the mind is a friend, it can help us. And if the mind is not our friend, it will not help us. Just like in the example of the blind person, right? The person who's supposed to help him is his enemy. So this enemy is taking him into all kinds of dangerous situations. You can imagine this. Now, even in real life, you have people on Facebook who really like you, and then you have people on Facebook who don't like you. They do different things to you, right? They send you different kinds of messages, different kinds of emotional energy, isn't it? A friend is somebody who wants your welfare, and an enemy is somebody who thinks the exact opposite. So now when Krishna says your mind could be your friend or your enemy, it's a startling point. That means that we could be living with an enemy. And, you know, unlike a friend on Facebook, you can't just block them, right? Ladies have to do this sometimes. They have to block somebody on Facebook because he sends them too many messages and they're not very appropriate, so you block the person so they don't see your profile, right? Can you just block your mind? Can you just wake up one day and say, okay, mind, don't like how you work. I really don't like the kind of thoughts you have. So we're just going to let go of you today. Can you do that? You can't. It's like your child, you know. It's annoying as they are sometimes, they're yours. You can't just abandon them. That's kind of like your mind, you're stuck with it. So when Krishna says the mind could be your friend or your enemy, it should really make us think twice, like, am I living with an enemy or am I living with a friend? And, you know, an easy way to tell is just to observe our thoughts, and then we can tell if the mind is our friend or if it's our enemy, right? Well, the good news is that actually, not only does Krishna warn us that your mind could be your enemy or your friend, he also prepares us for how the mind could become your friend. Wouldn't you like to live with a friend like the mind? So I thought of a few scenarios where the mind could act as your friend. Like, say you get up early, say you get up one morning, it's late, right? You were up late, and you get up, and you're supposed to go to attend to some important task, and the mind is like, and you feel really bad, you know, like, oh man, I got up so late, I slept so much. And your mind is like, it's okay, don't worry about it. You can still accomplish many things today. Just get up, go for a walk, get some fresh air, do a little yoga, have some muesli, you know, for breakfast. And make a plan, make a schedule, you know, and go about your day. You can do it, it's okay, don't be so hard on yourself, right? And as you go through your day, maybe you meet somebody at work or somebody on the street, and they're really rude to you, you know? They're really like, they say, and you feel like, wow, you just don't understand where I'm coming from, do you? Like, what do I have to say for you to understand where I'm coming from? No, they're not interested in where you come from. They're only interested in explaining themselves to you. They don't care about you. They only care about talking about themselves. And you feel like, wow, this person is so difficult. And your mind is like, stop, it's okay. Maybe they're having a hard day. Maybe you can be their friend. Maybe you can be kind to them today, and then they'll remember that. Because they're used to the people being mean to them, right? Because they're mean to everybody else. But today you can be nice to them. Your mind starts preaching to you like this. Like, relax. Relax, Harisham. It's okay. Don't find fault with them. Don't criticize them. Don't be mean to them. You give them a hug. You know? You be nice to them today. And then at the end of the day, maybe you're feeling a little exhausted. You're a little tired from working so hard. So you think, you know what? I should call my mom and maybe I should cook a nice breakfast, like, meal for myself. Instead, I'm just going to sit on my couch and watch a movie and forget about and just eat some French fries. And your mind is like, hey, come on. Come on. You said you weren't going to do that anymore. This isn't good for you. And then you're like, okay, fine. I won't do it. So this is your mind when it's your friend, right? But when your mind is your enemy, what does it say to you when you wake up late in the morning? Hit the snooze button. Go back to sleep, you know. Who wants to get up early and have a productive day? What a terrible idea. Just go back to sleep, you know. You deserve it. When somebody's mean to you, your mind says, yeah, what a rascal, you know. What a jerk. As you say in America, what a jerk. Some other things also, but we can't sit and repeat them in front of the Lord. Yeah, the mind will say like this, right? How can this person be so mean to you? How can they criticize you? This is so horrible. What a petty person, right? Just find fault with them, and then as soon as the conversation is over, you go and start telling everybody else, would you believe what this person said? They're so unreasonable, you know? And when you're feeling sad, your mind will give you other crazy ideas for how to not feel sad. They don't actually work, but your mind isn't your friend, so it's not there to help you, it's there to destroy you, you know? This is a very dangerous situation we're in, you know? The mind can help you or the mind can destroy you. So then, who here can resonate with this scenario? Does anybody here feel like my mind isn't always my friend? I definitely feel that way, right? Sometimes you wonder, why are you speaking to me like this? I don't want to think like this. Can you leave me alone? No. Right? So then it'd be nice to know, how can I be my... You know, and it's interesting, actually, because you find that when your mind is not your friend, even if you try something uber spiritual like chanting Hare Krishna, right, or going to a holy place, you find the experience wasn't so deep. You find that actually that activity wasn't able to penetrate your noisy mind and actually enter your heart, right? Don't we have that experience? That if your mind isn't cooperating, you can do something very spiritual and you can still be on the mental platform. You may not access the potency of that spiritual activity. So what Krishna recommends is a few exercises we can do with our mind. And the point of exercise is this. You don't exercise all day, right? You exercise for a half an hour in the morning, and then the benefits stay with you throughout the day, isn't it? It's not like you're exercising all day long. No, you just do it regularly for short periods of time. That's what an austerity is. An austerity, you can't live austerely all the time. An austerity, for those of you who don't know what that word means, it means you take on some discomfort for the sake of some benefit later on, right? Like say you're super hungry, and you have the option to wait and go home and make yourself a healthy sandwich, or just eat a huge donut. I don't know if donuts are... Pretzels. This is more popular in Germany, right? Pretzels. Not so healthy, but, you know, it's a pretzel. So then you accept some discomfort. Okay, I'll just tolerate being hungry so I can go home and eat a nice meal instead of eating, like, you know, some junk food, right? And the benefit is, over the long run, you're healthy. This is called an austerity. Generally, you take it up for spiritual reasons, like you agree to voluntarily, you know, follow certain principles and meditate every day and live by certain values for the sake of self-realization. It's called austerity, tapasya, like that. So, an austerity isn't something you do all the time. It's something you do for short intervals on a regular basis. And by doing that, you create a certain mental space that's very, very conducive for your life, that basically gradually makes the mind your friend. Does that make sense so far? So again, an austerity is something, it's a small thing you do on a regular basis at intervals to make your mind your friend. Okay, and Krishna recommends 5 austerities for the mind, or maybe for the sake of this class, we can call them 5 exercises that you should regularly do with the mind in order to make it your friend over a period of time. So, what are those 5 exercises? They're recommended in the 17th chapter of the Bhagavad Gita. I have the English text here. Do you want to grab the German text, Mangala, or should I just read it and you'll just translate? I'm just going to read the verse. I'm not going to read the purport. So Krishna says in the 16th verse of the 17th chapter, he says, and satisfaction, simplicity, gravity, self-control, and purification of one's existence are the austerities of the mind. So I'll repeat that list one more time. See if you can catch one or two that might be interesting to you. Satisfaction, it's an austerity. Simplicity, gravity, self-control, and purification of one's existence are the austerities of the mind. the benefit of doing these austerities, and we're going to go through this list now, is that when you do something long enough, your mind starts to like it. That's the beauty of the mind, actually. I'll give you a funny example. When I was 9 years old, I had my first beer. And I thought it was just absolutely disgusting. I mean, you know, I was at my uncle's house, and you know what adults do, right? Like, you're the kid, they're like, hey, come over here, try this. You take a sip, you spit it out, you're like, this is horrible, why would you give this to me, you know? And then by the time I was 16, it was completely different, you know? You're like, yeah, this is sehr gut. Yeah, beer is nice. Why? Because you do it so often that your mind becomes used to it. You start liking it. So it's the same with these austerities. We practice these five things regularly enough, and after a certain point in time, you don't have to force your mind to do these things. You like to do them. So let's go through this list and let's discuss them one by one. How much time do I have?
45 minutes left.
45 minutes? Oh, that's a lot. Don't worry, I won't speak so much. So the first exercise of the mind is called mana prasada, which means satisfaction or peace of mind. All of the great teachers in our spiritual lineage have explained that satisfaction comes from something very simple. You have to learn to say no to desires. The way the mind works is it becomes fixated on a particular desire, a particular experience, a particular object, a particular person. And as soon as you have it, the mind stops obsessing over it and you feel the satisfaction. It doesn't come from the object or the experience. It comes from the mind stopping its constant hankering. That's why they say many times that when you're not with somebody, but you're chasing after them, that's the best part. Then when you have the relationship, you're like, oh, okay, that's not so much fun. Or, you know, the new iPhone comes out and you can't wait to have it. You think about it all the time. Then you get it, and then you're like, okay, all right, cool, all right, no one. So, just a phone, you know? And you think, I'm satisfied. No, actually what happened is when you didn't have the object or the person, your mind kept thinking about it. And that was causing you a lot of like anxiety. Like, you keep thinking about, I really want it. I really want this phone. I really want this person. I really want that sweater. I really want that job. I really want that apartment. I really want that new hairstyle, you know? Then you get it, and your mind no longer thinks about it, so you feel satisfied. But actually, that's not true satisfaction, because it's just a matter of time before the mind starts thinking about some new desire, you know? You get the phone you wanted, then the mind says, well, you know what would go really well with this phone is this new cover. And then I might as well buy the expensive charger. And what about a really fancy leather case to carry it? Or in the case of, you know, the mind just expands. So you have to learn, we have to learn the simple art of learning to say no. Believe it or not, whatever you're hankering after, thinking this will satisfy me, you can be satisfied right now. If we just learn to say no, like, no, I don't need it. So I have a personal mantra that I practice that I want to share with you. I know we usually chant the Hare Krishna mantra, but here's another mantra you can try. You want to repeat it after me?
Mm-hmm.
I am all right.
All right.
I have what I need.
I have what I need.
I don't need this. That's it. You think about what's obsessing you, what's bothering you, what you really feel like you want, and the acharyas say no. I have what I need. I'm fine. Actually, we're fine. If you look at our life, mostly, more or less, what we need to live, we have. We live in a first world country. We don't have to worry about bombs dropping on our roof, right? So most of us have clothes and food and shelter. We're okay, right? So we can actually practice this and just say, I'm okay, I have what I need. And then all of a sudden you'll feel like, oh, I'm satisfied. This is the first exercise you can do with your mind. If you do this regularly, then we just become used to it. And then we don't become troubled by unnecessary desires. That's Krishna's promise. By the way, when I was studying these five principles, and I've studied them for some time now, I found out something miraculous, which is that basically every self-help guru and every like motivational speaker, everything they tell you is is contained within these five principles. When you study these five principles and learn their various applications in our life, you will find that actually every single modern self-help principle is contained within these five. Because even self-help gurus will tell you, if you want to achieve success in life, you have to delay gratification. That's the language they'll use. You have to delay gratification. Don't just go after the short-term goals, go after the long-term goals. That's how you find success in life. right? The short-term goal is, I don't want to work hard. I just want to be lazy. The long-term goal is, I want to have a degree. I want to get a job. So go after that. Delay your gratification. Don't just go after the immediate things that feed your mind, right? Just delay it for a while. So that's what Krishna is saying. Just learn to be satisfied. Just learn to say no. I have what I want. The next exercise of the mind is called somyatvam, which means simplicity, which is translated by Sri Ramanujacharya as benevolence. And Srila Prabhupada explains that simplicity means to think well of others. It means that you should desire the well-being of others. Why is this an exercise? It's an exercise because we live in a culture of envy. We often compete ourselves with others, and others compare themselves to us, right? And generally speaking, we're not always the nicest people to one another. Sometimes we may be a little mean to one another. We might do things that hurt somebody else, right? Sometimes the pain could be very shallow, sometimes it could be really deep, right? And the mind will find it very, very difficult to forgive, let go, and not search for justice. And believe it or not, like constantly wanting justice or revenge or, you know, the other person to ask for forgiveness is actually very stressful for the mind, right? So on one level, we should desire the welfare of others by praying for the welfare of those who have hurt us or criticized us, like that. On another level, we should see that everyone in this world is unaware of who they truly are, right? As we walk around this world, most people have no idea that they're eternal, that they're full of knowledge, they're full of bliss. So another level of or trying to work for the welfare of others is to give them spiritual knowledge. It doesn't have to be so direct. You may not sit down with them and be like, hey, by the way, Hans, did you know you're not the body? What is this? No, it may not be so direct. Maybe you just act in a spiritual way around them, you know? And by seeing us, they might think, well, what makes you so happy all the time, you know? So, but if you have this general consciousness, I want to do well for others, right? If you see somebody suffering physically, mentally, maybe you just talk to them for a few minutes, like try to put a smile on their face, right? If you see someone is spiritually curious, maybe you light that spark. Maybe you initiate a spiritual conversation. Sometimes we are afraid, actually, of bringing up spiritual discussions because we think people aren't ready to hear something spiritual, right? We feel this fear sometimes. We don't want to be that weird person. Like, come on, man, everyone's talking about football. Why you got to talk about spirituality, meditation? Just like, take it easy. So that's something we may have to work on our timing. We may have to know when is the right time to introduce these things. But sometimes, actually, people are very eager to listen to something spiritual. And in fact, something spiritual, even like a story, something subtle, might actually really inspire them. So at that point, we have to do our work. We have to be ready for that. We have to be prepared for that. Like, oh yeah, here's an opportunity to share something meaningful, something deep, something that might actually touch their hearts. I had a friend who went to his brother. He's a monk, also lives with me in Chicago. He went to his brother's wedding, and they asked him to speak at the wedding. And he was really surprised, but he just got up and told them the story of how he became interested in spiritual life. And he said it was so powerful, half the room started crying. Like, and these are very, very, very rich, upper-class people. It was a very fancy wedding on a private island outside of Florida. You know, half the room started crying. Because it doesn't matter how rich, powerful, wealthy somebody is, everybody's looking for truth, right? So if we can sense that everyone's actually looking for truth, and it's just a matter of time when they figure that out, but we should be ready to be able to share that in a loving, kind, caring way. This is what it means to be benevolent, to mean well for others, right? If we have the chance to help somebody physically, we do it. We can give somebody food. We can help them mentally by talking to them for a few minutes, appreciating something about them, giving them some encouragement. And we can help people spiritually by giving them some wisdom that we have received. But it's a certain attitude we're supposed to practice with our minds. It's an exercise. And when we're not around anybody, when we're just by ourselves, we can pray. We can pray for those who have maybe sometimes been not so nice to us, you know, or who are struggling in life. And if we practice this regularly, we'll find that on a regular basis, we're just generally being compassionate. We're generally concerned about other people, or, you know, we want them to do well, we want them to be happy, we're praying for their welfare. Again, it's an exercise, which means the more you do it, the stronger you become, right? So the more you practice benevolence, the more you practice compassion, the easier it becomes for the mind, the more natural it becomes for the mind. Is it making sense so far? Yeah? A good example, I thought about this. Does anybody know who is Bhakti Tirtha Swami?
Yeah.
Yeah, everybody? Some of you may not have heard. Bhakti Tirtha Swami was a great monk who, I believe it was 2006 when he died, no? 2006, 2007. Powerful personality. He was born and raised in the ghettos of Cleveland, Ohio, which is a very rough part of the world. And he went on to get a bachelor's in psychology from, was it Yale or Harvard? These are like, one of the other. It was either Harvard or Yale. And these are like some of the best universities in the world. And he went on to become a monk, actually. And he wrote books on leadership. And one of his most famous books is called From Lust to Love. I've read it. It's an amazing book. He wrote books on leadership that were being studied by heads of states, the president of South Africa. He was the personal life coach for Nelson Mandela, Muhammad Ali, some other famous people, you know? He met Charlie Chaplin, I believe. Anyways, this one I don't know for sure, but I know Muhammad Ali and definitely Nelson Mandela were he was counseling them. And other heads of states, like the president of Mexico, would study his books and have regular dialogues with him. He was on television. But he, at one point in his life, saw that the people in our society were suffering, the devotees were suffering because they weren't able to practice spiritual principles in a very committed way. And as a result, they were suffering. So he took a vow, he prayed actually, to let all the suffering of the devotees in our society fall upon him. And let him, you know, suffer for their pain so that they, it's like, this is like Jesus. This is like, this is some like modern day Jesus type stuff, you know? So let him suffer so that others can be happy in their spiritual life. And basically, a month after he wrote this prayer, he was afflicted with melanoma cancer, one of the most powerful forms of cancer, so painful that his bones would pain, his bones would hurt. He couldn't eat for weeks. And yeah, but in that condition, I've heard this amazing lecture by Radhanath Swami, who describes how they would sit together and read spiritual literature, and even though he was in so much pain, he would just be crying the whole time, not in pain. Not in pain, but because he was feeling the presence of Krishna. And in those days, people were coming to see him, this skeleton which is shrunk to something this big, and all of their pain and doubts for so many years that they were carrying were just being melted away by his association. You know, people are coming into his association, and all of their fears and anxieties were just melting away by his purity, by his love. Because this is somebody who had completely embodied the mood of compassion. He said at the end of his life, he wanted to do something to help others. And he said, I couldn't believe that Krishna will put me in a condition like this so that I could touch other people's hearts. And there were people who had become very negative, very dark, very confused over the years, who were coming into his room, talking to him for an hour, and leaving in tears, completely transformed. Their hearts were completely touched. Which is a very powerful message, because it goes to show us that anybody who becomes even really bitter in life, there is still some goodness in them. You know, we may not be able to find it for them. We may not be able to help them find it, but it's there. And when they meet somebody who is just compassion embodied, it'll come out. So this is very high. I'm somewhere over here, but we can at least look at the goal of wanting to be so compassionate and giving others spiritual knowledge and help in any way possible and make that a regular exercise. Right? Once a week we can sit and think, can I do something nice for someone? Yeah. Okay, I'll go on to the next one. So far we've discussed two exercises for the mind. Does anybody remember the first one without looking at your notes? Someone?
Be satisfied.
Be satisfied. How do you do that? Don't say it. How do we be satisfied?
Say no to desire.
Say no to desires, unnecessary desires. Some desires are useful. What's the second exercise of the mind that you should do regularly?
Simplicity.
And how do you practice simplicity?
Being nice to others. Caring for others.
Caring for others, being benevolent, like that. Very nice. Thank you. Wow. Wonderful. People are listening. So the third one is a little subtle. It's a little deep. It's called monam, which means to contemplate the self. Now, in strict spiritual terminology, to contemplate the self means to think about how you're eternal. You're separate from the body. You're separate from the mind. You're separate from your ego. You're the eternal soul, part and parcel of Krishna, meant to love him and meant to serve him. So what Krishna is recommending is that on a regular basis, you should make time to contemplate this reality. That I'm something eternal. I'm in this body, but I'm something eternal. And I'm full of knowledge, I'm full of bliss, I'm full of happiness. These are the qualities of my soul. I'm searching for these things in this material world, but actually I have to learn to search for them in the proper way. Right? Have you ever seen a book called Don't Be Happy? No? Have you ever seen such a book? Don't Be Happy? Don't Live Forever? Be Stupid? No, you never see these books because nobody has these desires. No one's going to buy such a book called Be Stupid. No, because everybody wants to have knowledge. Everybody wants to live forever. Everybody wants to be happy, right? You're from France. People want to be happy in France, right? You're from Russia. People want to be happy in Russia, right? What other exotic countries do we have? Anyway, we have Africa over there. Don't tell me. I think it's Burkina Faso, no? Where are you from? I forget. Cote d'Ivoire. Equatorial Guinea. Wow. Does anybody even know where that is?
No.
No. There you go. Small, tiny little country in Central Africa. But do people there want to be happy? Do they want to live? They want to live, right? Okay, good. Just making sure. So these are eternal qualities that are universal. We may not believe in God, we may not believe in the soul, but at least we can believe that these universal desires exist everywhere we go. So what Krishna is saying is contemplate that. Contemplate that that is you. On another level, this is at a very deep spiritual level. On another level, it's also very, very helpful to contemplate positive qualities that you want to embody. This is there in our scriptures. Chaitanya Mahaprabhu has said, Chunadapi Sunichena, Tororiva Sahisana, Amanina Manadena, Kirtanya Sadahari. So we can contemplate, I would like to be humble. I would like to give respect to others. I would like to be tolerant. So when it says contemplate the self, what it means is that you make some time on a regular basis to contemplate who you want to become, who we want to become. Fascinatingly, there's been studies done on this. They found out that when people have a regular habit of writing down the qualities they want to embody, their ability to take feedback increases by 70 to 80%. Which means that, say every day you make a list, right? Say Malini is like, okay, I want to be kind, I want to be very, very flexible with others. Whatever your list includes. I'm not saying these are your desires or this is what you should become, but you write down this list. Then they find out that when during the day you do something and someone corrects you for it, you're 70 to 80% more likely to accept that feedback and accept it and use it to improve than somebody who is not regularly making such a list. So it's very interesting. It's very, very powerful how even according to modern psychology, if you regularly contemplate the qualities you want to embody, then you become much better at going through life. So what to speak of on a spiritual level, if we start to regularly meditate on what we are spiritually and the qualities we want to embody to improve our spiritual life, then of course we'll gradually start to embody them, right? You become what you think, isn't it? We become what we think. So, there's one point, I should read this quote to you actually. I had all these notes because I thought I'll need my notes. I'm not even looking at them. But, okay, so which is not good because there's some good stuff here in these notes. But it's not me, so I'm just taking notes from the scriptures. So here's a quote from the Bhakti Sundarbha. It's really good. Why should you spend some time contemplating every day that you're an eternal soul, part and parcel of Krishna, meant to love him and serve him? Why should you do that? Why should you invest energy into cultivating that identity? So listen to what Jiva Goswami says. It's only three lines. Please pay attention. He says in the Bhakti Sundarbha, there is not even any real need for great effort in spiritual practice. Sounds like good news, right? You don't have to work too hard in spiritual life. Right? You know, you see some people doing all kinds of crazy austerities. It's okay, you don't have to work so hard. For if one simply believes with all sincerity, if you simply believe with all sincerity, not 5% sincerity or 20% sincerity, but all sincerity, you believe this, that he is the eternal servant of Krishna. That sense of spiritual identification will itself eventually give him all perfection. That's how powerful it is. If you actually believe that I'm not independent of Krishna, I'm meant to serve him and love him, that sense of spiritual identification will give us all perfection. That's coming from Jiva Goswami. I didn't make that up. So that's powerful. Okay, so the next exercise Krishna recommends. Is this interesting, by the way, these exercises Krishna recommends? Okay, all right. So the next, we have to regularly, you know, we're from America, and we're used to people having very short attention spans and getting bored very easily. So just have to make sure and check in with everyone that this is still relevant to you.
He's not wrong.
So, So the fourth exercise that Krishna recommends that is very, very useful, if done regularly, is called self-control or self-restraint. It means Atma Vinigraha. And Atma Vinigraha literally means to be able to hold a thought. Right? Have you ever tried to think about something and realize that you can't? Mm-hmm. That it's really hard? Mm-hmm. You try to hold this thought and it just slips out of your fingers. You know? It's very hard to just keep your mind concentrated on one thing. Very difficult, right? So Srila Prabhupada says, you can learn to practice this by regularly investing your mental energy into Puranas, books that have stories, like the Mahabharata, Prabhupada gives the example. Now why? It's very easy to concentrate on a story. Philosophical points are a little vague, right? They're a little vague, philosophical points are a little vague. So sometimes it's hard to like really practice concentration on a philosophical point. But when you read a story, like Prabhupada recommends the Puranas, the Mahabharatas, stories you can get absorbed in. I've been reading Mahabharata myself. Who here has read the Mahabharata? Maybe not completely, but partially even. Who here knows or doesn't know what the Mahabharata is? Are my two friends? It's an ancient epic from India. It literally means the great history of India. And it's the story of these two families, these two sons of two brothers who grow up together, but eventually go on to have a battle. Because one group of brothers is very cruel and unfair and wants to take the kingdom of the other set of brothers. So basically it's a story about righteousness and justice. But within it are many, many powerful lessons about life and how to live virtuously and morally. And within the Mahabharata you find the Bhagavad Gita, which is the conversation with Krishna and Arjuna. But anyways, it's a very amazing, like, Mahabharata is so exciting to read. It's like when you read it, you're like, it's like watching a movie or something unfold, you know, it's very powerful. So, and this way we learn this practice of being able to hold a thought, being able to concentrate our minds. This is very important. Most people nowadays, you'll find people don't like to read. And even when they read, they read for like, I notice this on the bus, you know, I'll watch people, they'll be reading, and they have to just get up, kind of like look around for like a minute or two, check their WhatsApp, send a few messages, put it back, read for another 30 seconds, then look up, look around, yep, it's going on, okay, back down to reading. I notice, I'm like, wow, it's just, but when people watch movies, or when they're watching something on their iPad, when they're watching a movie, they can just be staring at it for like a half an hour with their headphones on, it doesn't matter, it's just like complete concentration. So there's something about stories that really, you know, and of course at a higher spiritual level, if you can have that kind of absorption in Krishna's pastimes, and what to speak of, I mean, you know, imagine you're just going on the bus and you can just switch your absorption, and instead of being in, you know, like Friedrichstrasse, you're like in Braj, you know, absorbed in a lila, and that's, of course, it's the perfection. But we have to develop that art. We have to develop that art by practicing concentration now. So the last quality that Krishna recommends as a regular exercise of the mind to help us make the mind a friend is called bhava samshuddhi, which means purification of one's existence. How do we purify our existence? In this specific context, Krishna says, or the acharyas explain, we purify our existence by giving up duplicity in our dealings. Duplicity means double-faced. Many times it's very difficult to just be honest with people, right? I have the experience of meeting many devotees who are suffering sometimes for years because somebody hurt them and they just don't have the strength to confront them. They just don't have the ability to talk about it. You know, or they generally are very, very double-faced when they're going through life. You know, you ask them how they're doing, they'll give you a superficial answer. You know, when they talk to other people in their life, they give superficial answers. So we have this tendency to not be very transparent in our dealings with others, right? I tell Tushita Prabhu, I really care about you, please, you know, try this, but actually I don't really care about you and I'm hoping you try because then I'll get something in return. This is like the most common form of duplicity, is you try to pretend to be a friend or a well-wisher, but you have some ulterior motive in mind. You know, this happens, this is normal, this is material life, in human life, it's normal. But Krishna says, as an exercise, practice not being just carried by the flow of your mind and acting, you know, with duplicity. Practice transparency. I found for myself personally that it's regularly healthy to just honestly reveal to someone, like a friend or someone I care about, whatever I'm actually struggling with. This is very difficult. Sometimes we struggle with certain things and we're so embarrassed. We can't believe we struggle with these things, you know? I mean, it's just embarrassing. Like, wow, I thought I was kind of like spiritual and like a nice person, but I can't believe I still like doing this, you know? And like, how do you even admit that to someone, you know? It's just embarrassing. So I have a few people in my life. I have one or two people in my life that I trust completely who will never judge me. And I just tell them. As soon as I start struggling with something, I just email them and let them know that, hey, I'm struggling with this and I just wanted you to know this. And then they'll give me a few thoughts. And it's amazing. It's amazing how being able to reveal that to someone as a regular exercise actually helps me cultivate transparency in other relationships also. It allows me to also see that just as I struggle, others struggle also. There's no reason to pretend that I'm better than anyone because I'm struggling and others are also struggling. So maybe we can all just share this and help each other grow. But this happens when you have a regular practice of being transparent. And then also in other dealings, sometimes, you know, at the end of the day, we might reflect. I'm like, wow, I could have been a little bit more honest in that exchange. Another thing that really helps in developing transparency and giving up duplicity in relationships and in dealings is some sort of physical action. Sometimes if you have a difficulty with somebody, one of my mentors once told me this, and it works, it really works. Say you have an issue with someone and you're having a really hard time confronting them about it, just go up to them and do something that's going to completely shock them. Just offer your full obeisances. This means you just lay down in front of them and just ask for their blessings. And they'll just look at you like, what are you doing? And you just get up and say, look, I've been struggling with this and I just wanted you to know that, like, whatever it is, whatever the issue is, right? And if they're human beings, which most people are, they'll be so shocked by your transparency that the whole thing will just be over. Immediately, on the spot. You know? Just go up to them and offer your basis. I mean, don't do it at work, you know, if it's like a coworker or something, you're kind of weird, you know? Maybe then it's easier to just buy them a bottle of juice or, you know, maybe like bring them some fresh cookies or... That is also a nice gesture to create transparency. Just offer a gift and apologize, work it out. But anyways, sometimes these physical actions can also help create more transparency in a relationship. We can do it as an exercise, you know. We can actually force ourselves to do it. In the beginning, it's going to be tough because we're not used to it. But as we keep doing this, as we keep trying to live behind a mask, then eventually we'll see that we're just very transparent in most of our dealings. Sometimes you have to lie, it's the material world. Sometimes it is actually useful. You know what I'm saying? You can't always speak the truth all the time, right? In America, we have this joke, if your girlfriend looks at you and says, do I look fat in this dress? The answer is no, always. You know, so some lies are good. So, sometimes you have to know the difference. So I'll conclude then. We were talking about making the mind our friend and not making the mind our enemy. The mind becomes our friend when we learn to do the right things regularly as an exercise until the mind just has a taste for them, right? And there's 5 things Krishna recommends that we can try to practice regularly, which is, let's try to do this real quick. What's the first thing Krishna says we can practice regularly? Satisfaction. Wonderful. Second?
Simplicity.
Wow. Third?
Contemplate
the self. Very good. Let's get a little round of applause for it. Thank you so much. That was great. Fourth?
Transparency.
That was the fifth one.
No,
that was the second one. The fourth one was a little subtle. It was prolonged concentration, self-thought, self-control. She got it. Being able to hold a thought. And the fifth one was?
Transparency.
Yeah, give purification of one's existence, learning to cultivate transparency in relationships. So we talked about these 5 principles. By doing them regularly, the mind will become a friend, which means it'll start speaking to you in a nice way, like it'll start giving you good suggestions that'll help you on the spiritual path, progress towards the goal of life. And I want to make one last point. All of these techniques only work when there's an ultimate purpose to life. Because good and bad is all relative. It's all relative to something, right? So Krishna makes this point very clear throughout the Bhagavad Gita that these things that are good and bad, right? All of this is relative to some ultimate purpose, right? Because someone could say, well, what's better about having a compassionate mind versus an uncompassionate mind? I met somebody like that today when I was just reading books. He just wanted to argue. So every time I would say, you know, something, he would say, well, what's wrong with this? You know, why not have an uncompassionate mind? You know, we are animals after all. I said to him, look, That sounds nice. You just want to argue. But if I started treating you like an animal, you wouldn't like it for 1 second, right? If I started behaving like a monkey and started throwing my feces at you, you're telling me you would like that, right? Because according to your philosophy, everything is good. And then he kind of like calmed down. He was like, yeah, okay. So, you know, someone can say, what's better about a compassionate mind and a satisfied mind versus an unsatisfied mind and an uncompassionate mind? Well, what's better about a satisfied, compassionate mind is when the ultimate goal of life is self-realization. At that point, a satisfied mind, a compassionate mind, a transparent mind, a mind that can concentrate, a mind that's purified, wow, what an asset, right? What an asset. So the first thing that has to be set is the purpose, the goal. And this, by the way, all self-help gurus will tell you the same thing. The most important thing in life is knowing your purpose. For them, it means, I want to be a doctor, I want to be a magician, the best one in France, or whatever, my friend here is a magician. So for them, finding your purpose means finding what you want to be in this life, in this world. But for a yogi, a spiritualist, finding your purpose means who you want to be eternally, right? So when that's fixed in your intelligence, when you understand that, I want to be eternally. I want to be a soul eternally, right? I want to be with Krishna eternally. When that purpose is set, then you can start to see why having the mind as a friend, particularly with these qualities, is very useful. Otherwise, it really doesn't matter. Otherwise, it's just another feel-good thing that feels good for a while, then something else feels good. Because that's just how the mind works. For a while, it felt nice to be compassionate. For a while, it felt nice to give every beggar I see 50 cents. That was nice for a while. Now I like spitting at the beggars. That feels good. So I'll do that. You know, this is how the mind works. It likes some things for a while, it doesn't like. So, you know, that's what happens when there isn't a purpose, there isn't a goal. But when the purpose, when the goal is set, I want to be self-realized, then, okay, I want my mind to be my friend, I'm going to do it like this. Like that, and then the mind can be trained by doing these exercises. So I encourage all of us, including myself, I love talking about the mind because I feel like now I have to practice these things also. I just sat here telling everybody else about it. So this is mostly benefiting me, actually. So I hope all of us can take some of these points and, yeah, try to practice these exercises. Does anybody have any appreciations, criticisms, questions, concerns?
I have two questions. The first is, what is the definition of spiritual? Somebody asked me this question, I didn't know exactly.
So what is the definition of spiritual? That's the first question. And the second question?
One is, people ask me if there is evidence for God. This is, they say, this is just a claim.
So the first question is, what is spiritual, and is there evidence for God? So the answer to the first question is, spiritual basically means things related to eternality. So Krishna explains in the Bhagavad Gita that of that which is real, there is always existence. That which is actually real and true, it forever exists. And that which is illusion or temporary, it exists for some time and then it's gone. Right? So spiritual or sat, something that's real, for us means something that exists forever. So if you look around, what exists forever? This building doesn't exist forever. My body doesn't exist forever, right? These cars don't exist forever. This country doesn't exist forever, right? Languages don't exist forever, but the soul exists forever, right? The soul is eternal. Consciousness is eternal. It's an energy that can't be destroyed. So that's spiritual. That's the beginning of spiritual. And your second question was, is there any evidence for the existence of God? There's only one evidence for the existence of God. Well, we can also say the holy scriptures, but they might not believe that because for them it's just books. The only existence for God is the experience of saints. You have people in this world who were able to give up power, money, beautiful women. I mean, women also, there were many women in this world who gave up power and money and perhaps kingdoms. There were princesses who became saints, right? So both, we have men and women in this world who gave up everything that everybody's running after to pursue something else, right? Now, if they're not clinically crazy, because you could say maybe they're clinically crazy, maybe they have schizophrenia, maybe they have epilepsy, maybe they have some mental disorder, that's why they gave up their kingdom to go live in a forest, right? Let's assume they're not crazy. That means they're experiencing something that's much higher, right, than what their kingdom, what their job, what their powerful position in this world could offer them. That's the greatest evidence, that if someone can give up something for pursuing something else, and give up what? Not just something regular, but something that everybody's... Wouldn't you like to be... I mean, the Queen of Germany? That would be nice. Princess of England? That would be nice. And there's stories like that of princesses who gave up kingdoms because they wanted to worship Krishna. That's evidence, as far as I'm concerned. Their experience is an evidence. You can also ask them, can you prove to me that God doesn't exist? I often pose this question to people when they say, can you prove to me that God exists? I say, can you prove to me that he doesn't exist? How will you prove that God doesn't exist? How do you prove the non-existence of something? Sorry to get a little philosophical here. But you can't. There's no experiment you can perform to prove that there is nothing at the source of reality. Right? There is no experiment. But there is an experiment you can perform to arrive at the source of reality. And this experiment has been explained in the sacred literatures of this world, like the Bhagavad Gita, the Srimad Bhagavatam, other sacred texts. The saints have talked about it. That if you follow these steps, you can understand that there's a source to reality. Now the question is, someone could say, I don't believe in this experiment to know it, the source of reality. Well, then that's your fault, right? We have the experiment. We're trying to perform it. We're inviting you to also perform the experiment. And if you perform it, you'll get this result. And then someone could say, well, I don't believe that this experiment works. Well, how can you say that? You haven't done it. Yeah, that's true. Well, I just don't think it'll work. No problem. Okay, as you like. But the science is there. How to realize God at the source of reality. It's there. It exists. Some people may not. The biggest problem is most people fail. And that sounds a little harsh, but it's true. Many people fail at trying to discover the source of reality. And they become the examples for everybody else. You know, people say, well, look at so-and-so, you know, he was supposed to be spiritual and all this, but look at what he did, you know, what a bad person. Yeah, it's true, he failed. He failed. So there's so many examples of failures, but at the end of the day, the choice is ours, you know. My mother told me once when I was really young, she said, if you want to grow in life, look at those who are better than you. Don't look at those who are not as good as you are, or who are lesser than you. So if you want to really grow spiritually, you have to look at those who actually made it. That's what will give you the conviction that, okay, some people can do it, and they got it. So the experiment works. But see, also we should remember something Krishna says in the Bhagavad Gita, manushyanam sahasrishu kashchin yadati siddhaye, that out of millions upon millions of men, hardly a few are interested in liberation. And of those few who are interested in liberation, hardly one knows me in truth. So we shouldn't be surprised that most people are not interested in understanding the source of reality, because Krishna says it's very rare, and that most people fail. Because it's a multi-life process, I accept it. Probably going to be for me a multi-life process. I'm going to have to pick up a thing in my next life. So it's rare, it's difficult, a lot of people fail. But I can tell you this with great confidence, spiritual life is the greatest adventure. There's nothing like it. There's nothing like it. When you're actually aware and a little bit conscious of how my life is just a dance with God, but he hasn't shown himself yet. He's hiding behind the curtain, and he's waiting for me to make the right moves, and then he'll reveal himself. That's exciting. That's very exciting. If you can actually live in that consciousness, then spiritual life is the greatest spiritual adventure. It's not for the faint-hearted. Nobody likes knowing their north is. So yeah, anyway, sorry, maybe that was too long of an answer. But anybody else have a thought or something they would like to add here?
Thank you very much, Harishan Prabhu. I have a question. We are talking about now askeza of our minds. Mm-hmm. Our mind is sixth sense, yes?
Yeah.
Is it, it's training for we are trying to love God, for example.
Sure.
So it means our mind, we must be strange with our mind, because the our mind, he accepting and
rejecting.
So when we are rejecting bad thing, then love. It's in our soul, yes, quality.
Mm-hmm.
But our mind have no this quality.
No.
So, it was my question. So
I'm not sure what the question is.
We must be so strange with our mind.
Strange.
Strong.
You mean like we should be heavy with the mind?
Yeah.
Strict.
Yeah, we should. I mean, this is, so there's, in the 11th canto of the Srimad Bhagavatam, there's a very nice analogy that's given, that the mind is compared to a horse, okay? And sometimes, has anybody here ridden a horse? Anybody ridden a horse? Yeah? Have you ever ridden a horse that was a little bit stubborn? He refused to go where you wanted to go, right? You have that experience, no? Horses can be stubborn sometimes, right? Yeah? So in the 11th canto, it says the mind should be treated like a horse, which is sometimes a little stubborn. So sometimes you may have to yank, and sometimes you may have to let go. Let the mind just kind of go around a little bit, you know? Because if you yank too hard, the mind might become very rigid and like maybe even negative. You know what I'm saying? So it says that takes an expert rider, which means it takes somebody with a strong intelligence. This is the key point, a strong intelligence to know when to let the mind go a little bit and when I need to be really heavy with the mind. That's why, that's one of the reasons why it's so important to study philosophy, read these books, hear spiritual discussions, because they nourish our intelligence. You see, the function of the intelligence is to determine what you should go for. That's all the intelligence does. The intelligence simply determines this is good, this is bad. The mind has the function of now becoming attracted to the good or to the bad, right? But if the intelligence doesn't set something for the mind to become attracted to, the mind, like you were saying, will just be attracted to the things that it's accustomed to, like the things we always get attracted to that are not always good for us, right? So the intelligence has to play its role of actually establishing something for the mind to become attracted to, right? And that's why we have to nourish our intelligence regularly with some higher principles. Then you can, the intelligence can tell the mind, look, I want to be like this, I don't want to be like this. Then the mind might resist, no, but it's so nice to be like this, you know, I just sleep in a little bit more. No. I've already told you, I want to be like this. And then you have to pull the mind. But the intelligence has to do its part. This has to be very important. Intelligence has to lead the mind. Does anybody have any reflections? Anything you want to share with the group? Anything that I said that you thought could be useful? You want to share? Maybe somebody else, because everybody should, somebody else. Oh, yeah?
Well, you said that there is no book that teaches how to be unhappy, but yeah, there is, in fact, one by Harold Vaxlavik. It's called, in English, it would be Guidance to Being Unhappy, Anleitung zum Unglücklich sein. But in reality, it's just teaching to be happy by negative examples.
Uh-huh. Yeah, so even they try to write about unhappiness and we fail. It's just not our nature. I made this joke recently. I said, unless you're like Albert Camus, and then it's okay to write books called Why Be Happy. And he was, it doesn't matter, you know. But even he, you know, he wanted to be happy. That's why he wrote books. Can't get away from that. Can't get away from this point of wanting to be happy, you know. Somebody, yeah, yes, Prabhu?
With regards to existence of God, like my colleague in the hospital.
Yeah.
Recently I read an interesting thing about the same. Mm-hmm. Like a lot of people ask nowadays, like, does the God exist or not?
Yeah.
The best way to tell them is like, God is like a Wi-Fi.
Uh-huh. No.
The Wi-Fi doesn't. You can't see it. But when you provide the right password, you will connect with the God.
Uh-huh. Oh, that's nice. That's a nice
God
idea. Yeah.
You can't see it, but when you connect with Him,
yeah,
you will experience.
Actually, Krishna says the same thing in the Bhagavad Gita. He says, I am everywhere. I am in everything, right? But nothing is in me. Which actually means I'm available for everyone to know, but getting to know me is a little bit hard, right? He's in everything, but his personal form as Krishna, Bhagavan, is a little separate from this world. But the main point is he's in everything. He's everywhere. So yes, he's like Wi-Fi comparison. You have to have the right password.
What is the password?
I think we all know the password, which we'll sing now in public, no? Do we have 2 more minutes if anybody has a final reflection? Yes. Please hear what he has to say.
When you train your mind in the way you said, then in which way can you actually take this training to the next level? Is it like, I thought you the mind you also keep in the subtle body, like
the something. Mind?
Some qualities of the mind you keep in the subtle body when you go to the next body?
Yes, some tendencies will stay with you. So if you cultivate those good qualities now, then you see in your next life, your mind is born with certain positive qualities already. You know? like my little nephew, I'll tell you my little nephew, he's only 6 years old. It's so obvious he was a soldier in his past life. He can do like 100 push-ups and pull-ups. And he can walk around in the cold with his shorts. He's not afraid of anything. He likes to jump over fences and nothing. He's not afraid of anything. And I look at this kid, I'm like, man, you must have been like some like special armed forces, you know, German, you know, SS, who knows, you know. He's so tough. So yeah, it's true that these certain qualities will stay with us in our subtle body for our next life, which is why it's so important to cultivate these things now, because we can see that the qualities that we have in our life now that we don't like, we've been cultivating them for many lives. You know, we should let go of them, you know, and develop these qualities so that Krishna stops having to try to teach us these lessons. We get it, and then we can move on to the higher stuff. That's how life works. You keep getting tested on something until you pass the test. Just like when you're in university, if you fail the first semester, then you have to sit again in the first semester until you clear the exam. So these qualities are kind of like that. Until you develop them, you keep getting tested, right? So better we develop these qualities, learn the lessons Krishna wants us to learn, and then progress towards self-realization. You know? It'll stay with us in our next life. Yeah.
So that means the character that we have shortly before we leave the body is then the one that we will kind of have in the next body as well? Like then you could like...
Yeah, it won't be like 100%. Prabhupada gave this analogy. He says, he asked, one time somebody asked his exact question, and Prabhupada looked at the audience and said, he said, you, do you remember everything that has happened to you since you were born? Do you remember everything you've... No, we don't. Nobody remembers everything that's happened since they were born. So even in this life, we don't retain everything. So what to speak of from a past life? So you retain some portion of those qualities, especially the ones you really cultivated, and the rest is determined by your karma from your past life. So your karma from your past life will then determine your psychophysical condition in your next life, along with some of the qualities from your past life. But it's very complicated, and if you were to ask me how it all works, it's very subtle, you know? What aspect is your karma? What aspect are your qualities? How does it all work together? It's quite subtle. But yes, definitely something will stay with us. That's the essence. Yeah. So I think we'll... Maybe we can talk, because we have to end now. No, it's 5:45. Yeah, so we do Gorati now. Okay, so thank you very much for your attention. Please forgive me for any questions. Thank you very much.